Chapter 34. Hollis. Laundry should not be this complicated, he thought. There was a machine for washing. There was a machine for drying. Powdered soap goes into the machine for washing. It fills with water, it does its thing, soak, spin, whatever. The clothes come out and go into the dryer with a static guard sheet from the pink box on the shelf next to the soap. They tumble around for a while, the buzzer goes off, and that's all except for folding. So then why, he wondered in irritation as he lifted the washer lid, must Susan insist on overcomplicating absolutely everything? Last Hollis checked, Maytag did not manufacture thermonuclear reactors. He switched the clothes from one machine to the next, tossed in an anti-static sheet, and started the dryer. Then he picked up the laundry basket at his feet, lifted it over the hole in the top of the washer, turned it upside down, dumped in the clothes, added a level scoop of soap, dropped the lid closed with a clang, twisted a dial, punched a button, and whammo! Laundry done. Mission accomplished. Bring home the troops. He left the basket by the dryer and picked up his glass of Australian Shiraz, which he thought was particularly good for an impulsive purchase. He took a sip and let the wine roll around on his tongue. It certainly had not been necessary for Susan to call him on his cell phone. He knew the call had nothing to do with the laundry. She had been checking up on him. She had opted to abandon her life, her husband, and her son, for the lesbian campfire. No one forced her to do that. No siree. But now she saw the downside, didn't she? Now she could no longer keep tabs on him. And that, he thought with some dark satisfaction, must surely worry her a little. Now she was feeling some regret about just walking out on everyone to suit herself. Just what was Hollis doing and who was he doing it with? That was why she had called. She would have been far better to be honest about it and just ask him outright, "Are you off fucking that Bethany friend of yours?" Just ask, that's all. He would tell her. It demeaned them both to manufacture some great concern about needing to rewash the clothes she had forgotten and to hang and not dry this blouse or that blouse. "No, no, not the heat. Anything but the heat. Everyone will die." He was not an idiot. He wasn't rewashing a damn thing. Clean was clean, dry was dry. The call had been all about Susan's paranoia. The call had been unfortunate timing for both of them, for she had called him just as Hollis was about to place his order for the Hawaiian Macadamia Nut Waffle Supreme. He should have just let his phone ring and placed his order, but the impatience radiating off of "Hello, I'm Ruth," for whom it had taken Hollis all of 30 seconds to develop an intense loathing, made him want to take the call as she waited. "That be your wife," she said, pointing at him with her pen. "Calling to check up on where you been. She's catching on there, fella. She's no dummy."
"Hello, Susan, hold on a minute." Susan had waited for him to order and then deluged him with instructions on how to enrich plutonium, and he pretended to take notes over the phone. He was convinced that had she called him at home, the whole laundry ruse would never have happened. He would have been where he was supposed to be, out of trouble in his study or doing something with Ben. But he hadn't been at home. He had been out someplace she could not fathom, doing something out of the ordinary. She had no control and no information, and that was unsettling. The hyper-concern over laundry was partly an excuse for calling, and partly a coping mechanism. Hollis understood all this about Susan, and because he understood it, he was able to set the entire conversation aside and not let it upset him that his wife felt she needed to check in on him like a child or a paroled convict. Nor would he let it bother him that Susan, if he had understood her correctly, had imposed on David to come by and check up on him.
"It'll be good for him to see you," she had said. "He can check in on Ben."
That had been the giveaway. Check in on Ben. She wanted David to check in, Maybe Hollis was out every night drunk or fornicating in the streets, leaving poor Ben alone in front of 100 salacious cable channels as he scavenged through the garbage for scraps of food. This was all about Susan having some eyes and ears at home while she was off doing God knows what. She was gone, so she would send David over. She did not trust him. That much was clear. She trusted neither his motivations nor his competence. But Hollis knew better than to let the harsh judgments implicit in the lack of trust sink in. These were judgments born of fear and a lack of understanding, and while they might have been hurtful, had they been full-minded and well-considered, they were neither of those things, and not, therefore, to be taken seriously. So Hollis had dispassionately set the judgments aside with the rest of their conversation. He turned off the light and headed down the hall for the stairs, but stopped suddenly before ascending. The door to the old boiler room was open just a crack, and a bar of old yellow light sliced its way through the opening onto the hallway carpet, where it lay like a fallen log of amber. This was perplexing because Hollis had not been downstairs today, or yesterday for that matter, and he certainly had not been in the old junk room. He listened. The laundering machine hissed and rumbled from down the hall behind him. He adjusted his attention. There, in front of him, coming from the old boiler room, from the junk room, as the kids called it, where the past took its place on the shelf one passionate interest at a time, there was a shuffling sound, bodily movement. "Ben?" There was no answer. A thump followed the silence. Adrenaline up, Hollis proceeded past the stairs to the lit door and pushed it open. Ben sat on the concrete box in the back of the room, his back against the old iron boiler. His headphones were on, leaking a high-pitched distortion into the air. In his hands, he held Susan's old flat-top Guild acoustic, the black case open at his feet. The guitar was stringless, as it had been since the late 1970s. Ben was hunched intently over the body, head down, eyes closed, gripping the neck with his left like a backward tennis racket, and exercising demons over the sound hole with his right. His body swayed and shook, and his face was as close to a hardened grimace as Ben could ever get. On any other face, it was an expression that bespoke some horrifically soulful pain, a knife blade to the heart. On Ben, it looked more like he had been forced to eat something awful. Raw anchovies, maybe, or liver. But Hollis could make the translation easily enough, adjusting for his son's open features and limited expressive range. His mouth opened and closed and contorted, shaping soundless lyrics. Hollis slowly pulled the door back to where it had been, backing out of the room. He paused at the doorframe, smiling at the authentic innocence in Ben that never ceased to touch him. Ben looked up briefly and opened his eyes, perhaps sensing some change in the room around him. But the music in his ears and the scene in his head took him back quickly, and he returned to strumming and picking at strings that were not there, shaking and swaying and belting out raw emotion to untold millions, no doubt a live, worldwide broadcast from this tiny amphitheater of wooden shelving rising up around him on all sides. His trusted axe plugged into the massive black cylindrical speaker towering behind him on the concrete pedestal, which, to the uninitiated, might have looked for all the world like an old iron boiler. Hollis backed down the hall and took a seat on the stairs. He had a drink of wine and remembered Tilly, unbidden. She had loved to entertain herself in that room back in the days when the boiler was actually a boiler and not an imaginary speaker, or whatever Ben thought it was. How many times had he found her down there sitting in precisely the same spot, inches away from a tank holding 30 gallons of scalding water? Tilly had befriended the damn thing, named it Helga. No, not Helga. Greta. That was it. Greta the boiler. Greta had long since been decommissioned and painted a solid, glossy black. My God, he mused. How many years since he had remembered Tilly and Greta? The conversations he and Susan had overheard, eavesdropping together from this very step, as Tilly had explained to Greta the things only children knew.
"My, oh my, she has some secrets," Susan had laughed, whispering in his ear. "This kid doesn't miss anything."
How much had changed? Tilly had been innocent once. She had been pure with a child's imagination. She had befriended a boiler with whom, she had taken to intense, brow-furrowing conversation as she colored mermaids and drew elaborate undersea kingdoms and pretended that they, she and Greta, were in a submersible exploring the depths. But now, she was lost to the world now, the innocence gone a thousand times over, hating him and all this from whence she had come. David had grown up, matured, evolved. But Tilly had simply left. Tilly had become part of a different species, and now it seemed that after all this time, Greta had made a new friend. The washer stopped filling and began its sloshing and agitating. There was a clunking sound from the junk room, followed by rasps and mumbles that he could not discern. Hollis took another drink of the Shiraz. He thought about the idea of his daughter changing wholesale, while his oldest son had continually evolved into more mature versions of himself. He thought this to be a rather profound analysis, and he entertained a thought that he had entertained many times before, a thought every bit as fanciful as Iron Greta herself. What if Tilly had turned out more like David? What if she had followed a normal trajectory? He thought she'd probably be a lawyer. That seemed to fit her. She'd have a husband in the public accounting field, or maybe a comptroller for one of the hospitals. The husband would want her to go to church, and Tilly would hate the idea because she would be too independent-minded for such nonsense. But she would indulge him because she adored him, and for the sake of the kids, of which there would be at least two. She'd be smart as a whip, of course. It just was not possible to imagine Tilly any way other than smart. But she'd be smart in a way that was not so acerbic or disrespectful. She'd be useful smart. She'd be incisive, but not destructive. And by destructive, Hollis intended that word to include all manner of self-destruction. She would have matured into adulthood without the drinking and the drugs and the sex. True, Hollis had never been sure just how much of Tilly's white-knuckle adolescence had been for real and how much of it had been a well-orchestrated drama for him to fret over. A War of the Worlds production of Leave It to Beaver. Nevertheless, a normal adolescence would have avoided the concerns of self-destruction, real or imagined, altogether. He knew the world was a very different place than when he had come up. Tilly was not Hollis, and he was not Homer, and 1980s Columbus had not been 1950s Cincinnati. He knew that he had not been an unreasonable father. He had not expected Tilly to live by the rules of a different era. But it had also not been too much to expect that Tilly follow her brother's lead into adulthood. They had never had to worry about David. David had been so easy. David obeyed. David accepted. David appreciated. But Tilly. He and Susan had resorted to the gallows humor of supposing there was something genetic at work. "Could be worse," Susan had said once, after another dinner had been destroyed by senseless arguing and slamming doors. "Matilda Leone burned down her home in Barcelona before stealing away to Indiana to marry my great-grandfather." He had not answered her, and it was not until they had gone to bed that Hollis's anger over the evening had subsided enough for him to reply. "Was that comment about Matilda supposed to put me at ease?" he asked. "Now I'm afraid to go to sleep." She was no David. Tilly seemed to relish being everything David was not. She had worn Hollis down, or she had tried, with her refusal to acknowledge his authority. The music wars,
The dinner table rages, the strong opinions about everything she encountered, the harsh judgment of others. Her punked-out, over-pierced, unhygienic, wastrel loser friends. Not to mention the parade of stubbly, pot-reeking suitors marching through his home on a rotating basis. He could have done without all that. And yet, even as bad as all that had been, it was all preferable to Tilly's periodic disappearances. Anyone seen Tilly? Not since last night. Not for 2 days now. Not for a week now. Not for 2 weeks now. All they could do was worry and wait for a call from the police, or the coroner, or whoever's horrible job it is to call the parents of a dead child. In retrospect, he would have endured all the rest of it if she had just stayed home. Of course, as Susan was overly fond of reminding him, it had been Hollis who had called Tilly's bluff the first time she had threatened to walk out and live somewhere else. Even after all the intervening years and the ample opportunity to polish up the facts and to see things from a kinder perspective, it was one of the few misjudgments that Hollis had continued to acknowledge. It had been a stupid argument, something about her demand for a stereo that Hollis had refused to purchase for her. But any argument would have done. She had been waiting for a reason, for any opportunity to issue her threat to walk out. And when her opportunity came, she had taken it. Through all the snot and tears, she had thrown down the gauntlet in the middle of the evening news. Hollis had hardened his face and bent down to his daughter, standing before him in the living room, defiant, enraged, and he had stared directly into those drowning, gorgeous, green, bloodshot eyes, ignoring the quivering lips and shaky knees, and Hollis had pointed rigidly toward the front door. He never should have done that, he knew. But he was tired of the daily combat, tired of the profanity and the disrespect, tired of the continuous challenge. Susan had tried her best to interject, to change the direction of things, but he had silenced her with a look that demanded unanimity. How many times had they agreed? No divided parenting. Susan had demurred and held her tongue and let him run the show. If Tilly was going to resort to threats of leaving, then Hollis, her father, would goddamn show her who had the real control in that house. He would call that bluff, and she would forever regret making such idle threats just to get her way. He had had quite enough of the insurrection. The door is right there, Tilly. Do us all a favor, won't you? But he should have known that Tilly was calling all bluffs in that house, and that he, Hollis, the father, had been the one making idle threats. She had come back, of course, the very next day, shaken and crying, and Hollis had at least been smart enough not to ask questions or to rub her face in it. Susan had swooped into a kind of super maternal overdrive, doting on Tilly in a way that either dangerously rewarded her behavior or suggested that home was a good place to be. Hollis, meanwhile, had silently chalked up a tenuous victory in the Tilly Wars and had hoped that his dose of hard, cold reality had put the end in sight. In a very real way, he had been right. The end was in sight. Only not quite the end that he had been expecting. It certainly had not been the end of Tilly leaving the house in defiance of his authority. That part had just begun. What he did not realize then, but came to realize in rather short order, was that he had started a pattern of disappearing, which seemed to become easier and easier for Tilly. Each time she left, the parting had been less emotional, less momentous, less consequential. Each time she had returned, there were fewer tears and less conciliation in her eyes. She was stronger, even more independent, if such a thing is possible. They had rarely known exactly where she went, other than that she was staying with friends. Each time she left, she seemed to stay away longer than the time before. But Hollis knew this was only a vagary of memory. Before the last half of her senior year in high school, when she was almost never living at home, the duration of her disappearances,
actually varied fairly dramatically. A day, then a week, then 3 days, then 2, then 10. But what Hollis tended to remember was a different kind of disappearance. A kind of absence that accumulated and piled up like drifts of snow between them. Even when she was back at home. Even when she was civil and pleasant. No, he remembered, especially when she was civil and pleasant. It was that kind of disappearance that he remembered having gotten longer and longer. The irony was that for all the worry and dire predictions, Tilly appeared to have suffered no adverse consequences from her early turbulence. To this day, sitting on the stairs in the basement of the house to which she had all but set fire, Hollis had no evidence that Tilly had ever suffered any injury, trauma, or hardship from her poor choice of friends and reckless, or presumably reckless, living. They had never received the late-night phone call from the morgue. She had never been arrested. She had never been hospitalized. Never beaten up. Never overdosed. There were no scars or needle tracks. No car accidents. No angry complaints from Ohioans whose sleep had been disturbed or property destroyed. Her friends had been thoroughly pierced and tattooed, but Tilly, not at all. There had never been any hint of childbirth, abortion, or venereal disease. School attendance was good. Teachers were more than pleased. SATs, impressive. She had left no opening for comeuppance. Even if she had promised to sit still and listen, Hollis had never had any reason to say to her, "You see there, Tilly, that's what you get. Maybe you should just reconsider your choices." There had been no just desserts to serve as a corrective remedy, and Hollis could not help but find that immensely frustrating. Their friends who knew Tilly thought her delightful and destined for some notable but conveniently undefined success. "Oh, if you only knew," he'd insist in vain. "Nonsense, Hollis," the friends would say. "She's beautiful and she's smart. She's got Susan's grace and her father's charm. That kid is going places. You wait and see." Such predictions tended to come from people who had known Tilly in her adorable pre-feral years, particularly people like Rhonda Davenport, who had tended to treat Tilly as a niece rather than the daughter of a friend, and neighbor Heinrich Van Susteren, who, unlike his wife Inga, had forgiven Tilly for her assistive role in David's football reclamation fiasco that had accidentally flooded their basement with a lot of salt water and exotic tropical fish. As for Inga Van Susteren, Hollis had never broached the subject of adolescent Tilly. Had he done so, Inga probably would have been able to offer Hollis the greatest commiseration of all their friends, since Inga would have seriously considered demonic possession as the root of the behavioral and relational problems that only Hollis and Susan seemed to see. For all her hours of taking care of the kids when Hollis and Susan had evening engagements, Inga had never really been able to start over with Tilly or David after the asphyxiation of a dozen of her vanity fish. Inga was determined to see malice rather than childish mischief. But then, that was Inga, who often needed to be talked out of the rafters when it came to the suspected machinations of others, including most frequently her husband Heinrich, who had not gone quietly into that good night of middle age. Bill Swenson, the doctor who had delivered Tilly into the world, a motionless, icy blue tragedy, and in that sense the first person to really experience Tilly, had been more philosophic. "She knows how to play dead, Hollis. I'll bet she knows how to play Hellion." "She's not acting, Bill, believe me." "You sure about that? Usually it's not really who they are, it's just their way of getting your attention. That little personality is a work in progress, Hollis." "There's nothing little about that personality." "Yeah, well, whatever the size, that personality will start to harden, you know. What is she now, 17?
16, going on about 38.
"That's about right. She's trying to figure out who she is. Not an easy thing.
Easier for some than others. Easier for me. Easier for David." She's obviously got more to figure out. My guess is there's something on her mind. She's angry. She's afraid. Something. What? You're an OBGYN, Bill. What the hell do you know? Hey, I've got three of my own. Please. They're model children. They were all hellions at one point or another. I'm telling you, Tilly is in a league all her own. Maybe, but I'll bet she's got something on her mind.
Like what?
You tell me.
I wish I could. Why had those words stuck in his throat? Had that been a lie? Had he been the one acting, playing dumb, playing dead to his daughter's need to understand? Nonsense. Fortunately, Bill Swenson had needed a refill, a task to which Hollis had immediately devoted his entire consciousness, and the conversation had rolled past inquiries that were meant to lie dormant.
You know, it could be she doesn't even know what's really bothering her. Or could be she's afraid to talk about it. Thought about family counseling?
Nah.
I've got a name or two. Mark Price is good. You know him.
No, Bill. Thanks. Tilly's not afraid to tell me anything. I don't think she's having any trouble communicating. You may not have noticed, but she's a rather direct girl. Next time you come over, I'll hide you in the closet so you can see for yourself.
Well, she's a great kid, Hollis. Started her life by surprising and scaring everyone. I don't think she's done by a long shot. The simple answers will never apply to Tilly. I know it's concerning.
No, I'm fine with Tilly. She is a great kid, and she's just growing up.
Powerful thing, though.
What's that?
The need to be heard, Hollis. She's trying to figure out who she is.
Mm-hmm.
And that's an interactive process, you know? Who she is depends on you. You're part of that process.
Mm-hmm. Yep. It seemed there, for a miraculous moment, that was still suspended in his memory like a bubble bouncing between more sharply pointed recollections, that Tilly would pull it all together. He had found reason to hope that maybe it really had all just been a stupid phase. Just as he had told Bill Swenson. He had hoped that her intellect had finally subdued her anger. An identity to which Tilly could grow and call her own had finally presented itself. She was to be a writer. I was raised against my will to follow the fabulist tradition. It's a part of me now. The truth, she said, lies in fiction.
At least, so she had informed David. She had been out of the house for good by then, and while she stayed in regular, if perfunctory, touch with her mother, any contact with Hollis had been rare. Even as to David, with whom she was close, Tilly had revealed her new calling in life only once it had become irrevocably public knowledge that she had won first place for her age group in a statewide competition for short fiction. The Columbus Dispatch had printed a small article on the contest that Hollis had failed to catch. A call from David had sent Susan digging through the trash. The headline had read, Wilson High Senior Wins Big, Updating Angus Mann Classic. It had been several months later that Hollis actually sat down and read the winning story. By that time, it had been submitted for national recognition, although it would ultimately fail to place or garner any further attention. He could now recall virtually nothing about the story, the title, the plot, the point. Science fiction, he thought. Something about space travel. He knew nothing of Angus Mann except that he, like Zane Grey, Sherwood Anderson, and Toni Morrison, was an author the state of Ohio liked to take credit for from time to time. Hollis was not a consumer of popular fiction any more than he was a consumer of popular culture. It was not the story itself he had found remarkable, so much as the fact that Tilly had written it. He recalled the dissonance he had felt in realizing that his hellion daughter not only had an interest in creative writing, but, apparently, an unusual aptitude for it. He had had no earthly idea. The Dispatch article had produced in Hollis the first in a quick succession of good feelings about his estranged daughter, all of which had coalesced into an alien feeling of fatherly pride that he had then nursed for many months thereafter. Family and friends learned of Tilly's success and were quick to lavish their congratulations on Hollis and Susan. Even his mother, Marianne Easley Johns, then a widow and in the last 2 years of her own life, had called to take some genetic credit for Tilly's success. Susan had not explained that it was actually Tilly's namesake, Matilda Leona, from Susan's side of the family, that had been the fiction writer. College had come with virtually no assistance or direction from either him or Susan. Susan had prodded Tilly for assurances that she was tending to business. Hollis had cornered her for a lecture or two themed around the hard lives of uneducated cashiers and the statistical improbabilities facing those who depended on the performance of any subgenre of rock and roll music for a living. Improbabilities not just in being financially successful. But, given the drugs and mayhem Hollis knew to be associated with that lifestyle, improbabilities of living past the age of 38. Although Tilly had never shown any genuine interest in being a professional musician, professional groupie had not seemed beyond the pale as an option that she might be kicking around. But Tilly had invited both Hollis and Susan, in no uncertain terms, to butt out of her affairs. She had not provided assurances. She had not, for their peace of mind, ruled anything out of her future. Having a daughter living as a punk rock groupie, making change at the local thriftway, had been left on the table for him to ponder. As it turned out, Tilly had applied for and received a writing scholarship to Wesleyan. Not Allegheny Wesleyan in Salem, Ohio, and not Ohio Wesleyan in Delaware, Ohio, but Wesleyan University in Connecticut. So it was not an Ohio school. It was not Antioch, for instance, or Xavier, or Kent, or the University of Ohio, which had been Hollis's delicately declared hope, just as it would have been the strong preference of his Ohioan loyalist parents. David had left the state to be educated in Louisiana, of all places. Ben was not college-bound at all. Barring grandchildren, that had left Tilly as the only hope for a diploma from within the borders of the Buckeye State. Hollis's siblings, Maribel and Clayton, each had 2 children, and each of those children had gone on to excel in fine Ohioan institutions, 2 at UNOH, 1 at DeVry, and 1 at Ashland. Marianne Easley Johns had been the proud product of the University of Ohio at Lima, and her father, the venerable Benjamin Easley, had an honorary fellowship at UNOH Columbus for his generous contributions to their business and natural sciences programs. And then there was he and Susan, she at Kent State and he at Northwestern School of Commerce, which was now the University of Northwestern Ohio, or UNOH, not to be confused with either the University of Ohio or Northwestern University in Chicago, to which he had never applied for fear of being politely asked to leave the family. Hollis had picked the University of Northwestern Ohio, a small college tucked away in the seat of Allen County on the banks of the Old Hog Creek, where a proud history of railroading and oil drilling had surrendered to a future guided by a more genteel and better-smelling consumerism marshaled by the likes of the Ford Motor Company and Procter & Gamble. He had chosen the school because it touted a specialty in business education, because his successes would be his own, and because it was a school founded in the great state of Ohio. It was only natural for Hollis to have wanted at least one of his own children to continue that legacy, however modestly, through an in-state enrollment. The decision of his firstborn child not to apply to a single Ohio school except for UNOH Columbus had been difficult for Hollis to fathom, except as an extraordinarily gutsy move, given David's only slightly above-average grades. After all, they might have declined, and then where would he have been? But confirming much about the world and Hollis's connections in it, UNOH did not decline. David's letter of acceptance had been signed by Henry Cahill, Dean of Admissions, who had referenced Hollis as a good friend and had acknowledged Benjamin Easley as one of Ohio's great business pioneers, concluding that UNOH would be proud to share in David's undeniably bright future. It had been a moment of tremendous pride for Hollis, warranting a confiscation of the letter for framing and a nearly immediate phone call to Henry Cahill to thank him and to make plans for him and David and Susan to take Henry and his wife, Eunice, out to celebrate, so that Henry could meet David in person. David's lackluster response to the dinner idea had been irksome, but not particularly troubling, for David had always been given to bouts of mysterious sullenness when it came to acknowledging his indebtedness to others. It was not troubling, but maybe it should have been. David's ultimate decision to actually reject the invitation from UNOH Columbus in favor of an invitation from Tulane, a decision that had come just 1 week before a ridiculously awkward dinner with the Cahills, had left Hollis mortified. Obviously anticipating Hollis's opinion on the issue, David had mailed in the Tulane acceptance before announcing his decision. Just as the intransigent humiliation of the Vanguard Academy was ready to give way in the dawn of a new academic era, David had found a way to give new life to that bitter taste. Hollis had once again traded on his hard-earned business relationships for the benefit of his son, and, just as Charles Compson before him, Henry Cahill would shake his head at the misjudgment of extending Hollis a hand. It had not occurred to Hollis that perhaps David saw the dean's letter as an invitation for another Vanguard Academy-sized disappointment and had rejected UNOH simply to avoid the risk of failure in his father's eyes. At the time, all Hollis knew was that his son had the judgment of a horsefly. In the throes of his disappointment, Hollis had strung together a dozen examples of David's incredibly poor decision-making. From the decision to send his little sister into the Van Susteren home after a football, to the constellation of bad decisions as a student of the Vanguard Academy, to the confounding decision to reject a personal invitation from the Dean of Admissions to attend UNOH Columbus, all of which had seemed to come at Hollis's expense. Of course, the expense of attending Tulane, including tuition, travel to and from the great state of Louisiana, and all the incidentals, far exceeded what Hollis would have paid for an education to be provided closer to home. David had charted his collegiate course, taking it wholly for granted that money would not be an issue. And even though money had not, in fact, been an issue, for Hollis would certainly pay whatever it took to educate his children, he had had to quell a sense of resentment. Too often he had felt that his essential role as a provider was at best unacknowledged, and, not infrequently, as when he used his reputation and his network of associations to open important doors, his contribution was seen as an inconvenience to be managed and outmaneuvered. Had he been less of a father, had he been less selfless where the interests of his family were concerned, he could easily have sharpened the point of his indispensability. He could have told David that Tulane was his choice to make, but that he would need to get a job to defray the extra costs. But he had not done so because it was simply not in him to do so. He would provide. He would shepherd. He would pay the money, and he would open the doors, and he would offer wise counsel, and they, in turn, could take the money, and they could slam the doors, and they could take or leave the wise counsel. His children's success in life would be its own reward, rendering all expressions of gratitude for his role in that success superfluous. And so, with Hollis's full blessing, unblemished by lecture or recrimination, David had disappeared off to Tulane without need or worry. David gone, Hollis had set his hopes, albeit tentatively, on Hellion Tilly for an Ohioan post-secondary education. But he knew now that that was always the thing Tilly was the least likely to do, precisely because it was something he, Hollis, had wanted. Not wanted in a selfish way, but wanted it for her. Had he been thinking, rather than delicately extolling the virtues of Ohio colleges, he should have been demanding that she go to school out of state. Then she might have stayed. But when the time came, Hollis had not let himself become too disappointed with Tilly on that score. The eye-popping tuition statements from Tulane had gone a long way toward inuring him against the distress of failed expectations in willful children, teetering on the precipice of adulthood. All pain came from resistance. Wesleyan was a good school, even if it was in Connecticut. Hell, Wesleyan was, at the very least, a school, and not the name of a new rock and roll phenom. When the admissions envelope from Connecticut arrived, he had extracted it from the stack of bills and held it up to the light, and then taken it upstairs to Tilly's room. He leaned it carefully up against the glossy red telephone shaped like a pair of lips. They sat, as they always had, in a perpetual pucker on the empty night table next to the bed in which Tilly never slept. He could not tell its contents, but he had had a good feeling. He had looked around him at the room, marveling at the contrasts, from the poster homage to 1980s punk icons, to the lace curtains and matching bed ruffle, to the volumes of F. Scott Fitzgerald, Flannery O'Connor, Ray Bradbury, Anton Chekhov, Leo Tolstoy, Mark Twain, Oscar Wilde, and a dozen others, to the yellow vinyl beanbag like an enormous goldfish in the corner, a leftover from the house in Dayton before his mother had swept through in a fit of unwelcome refurnishing, that he had pulled out from the corner of the junk room and given to his daughter when she was 7. He had marveled that all of it was her, was Tilly, and yet no combination of it added up to who she was or what she wanted, whatever that was. "The simple answers will never apply to Tilly," Dr. Swenson had said. When next she appeared, Hollis had followed her down the hallway to her room as nonchalantly as he could and loitered in the doorframe. Tilly, his daughter, her long hair pulled back in a loose braid, tan and clean and healthy and shaped suddenly like a grown woman, suddenly just like her mother on the bleachers at the pool when he had seen her for the first time, pushing himself out of the water, his eyes on hers in a revelation of everything that was to be. Tilly had casually picked up the envelope off the nightstand and turned it over. "Have you read it?" she asked, not turning around.
"I don't open your mail."
"Not the letter. The story. My story."
"Not yet. It's on my nightstand. I've got so many things I'm reading. Not fiction, really. I've got a variety of books I'm reading. Some books on philosophy, a book on meditation, a book on the Buddha. But I'll get to it." She had turned and handed him the envelope.
"You open it," she said.
"Me?"
"I want you to be the first to read this."
And just what had that meant? So like her. The words honorary, the tone laced with a barely deniable truculence. "Really?" His tone skeptical. "You want me to be the first?"
"Yes."
And so he had been the first. "Dear Miss Johns, Wesleyan University is pleased to offer you..." It was short and sweet, promising materials to follow. "Congratulations, kiddo."
"Thanks."
And then, unceremoniously, she had turned and left him in the hallway with a lump in his throat and his eyes welling over. He had not even minded that she could see his emotion, that she would know that she had such power over him. She could know that he was sorry for all that had gone wrong between them, that she had won, that whatever the goddamn struggle was all about, she had won. He had been willing for her to take that victory with her. And yet, while Hollis had hoped she would perceive and understand his emotion, he had not been willing, he had not been strong enough, to stop her and tell her those things. The opportunity between them had stretched and then snapped at the length of the damn hallway. Shortly after, Tilly had graduated from Bertrand G. Wilson High School in the upper 3% of her class, higher than her brother by a sizable margin. After the graduation ceremony, Hollis did not lay eyes on her for nearly 3 weeks, and then only in passing as she picked up clothes and mail on a day when a late afternoon dentist appointment had brought him home earlier than otherwise would have been the case. It was a foreshadowing of the college years that were to come. She called home every couple of weeks, always during the day. She told Susan whatever she was willing for her mother to know about the life of a Connecticut co-ed, and Susan, in turn, had dutifully related the news to Hollis over dinner when he returned from work. Hollis listened to such soundbite dispatches from the front lines of academia with genuine interest, but a feigned satisfaction. Theirs was to be a relationship by proxy, and he knew it. Whatever the dinnertime reports, the telephone bills had suggested that while Susan faithfully related the news, it was also true that she was not relating the full subject matter of the conversations. Hollis did not believe it likely that it took Tilly 75 minutes to explain that she had a cold and was enjoying her 19th-century lit class. No, they were spending a lot of time on the telephone, and the dinner table reports were far too scant to account for all of it. The calls had become about long-distance mother-daughter bonding, an intimacy of listening that strangely had not been possible living beneath the same roof or in the same city. That Susan had evidently found a way through to Tilly was wonderful. Good for Susan. Except that it wholly excluded him. While he was off earning money to pay for the phone bills, his wife and daughter were enjoying leisurely afternoon bonding opportunities. Worse, and more to the point of his unease, Hollis began to suspect that the bonding had taken on a momentum and an intensity that can only come with commiseration. The girls were really talking. It had not been long before the calls to Connecticut were as common as the calls from Connecticut. The calls to Connecticut tended to be much longer on the days that followed arguments between Hollis and Susan, which occurred with a far greater frequency and regularity than the calls from Connecticut. The jig was up the night Susan had suggested, if it is possible for one to scream a suggestion, that they seek a marriage counselor to introduce a more productive and supportive dialogue into the relationship.
"That's the most ridiculous thing you've said all night."
"It's not ridiculous, Hollis. It's not. You're just afraid some neutral third party is going to tell you that your drinking is interfering with your ability to relate to other people."
"That's simply insane, Susan."
"Is it? Am I insane? Is Tilly insane? Try telling Tilly she's insane for thinking you drink too much. Try telling Tilly she's insane for thinking we need counseling."
Yes, the girls had really been talking.
Tilly had returned home for 3 of the 4 Christmas breaks and 1 of the 4 spring breaks. Whenever she returned, they had picked her up at the airport, Susan fussing and clucking and keeping Tilly occupied with the latest gossip as Hollis slung luggage off the carousel, onto the carts, and into the car, waving off Tilly's protests. When she was home, she re-inhabited her old, all but abandoned bedroom, which they had been careful not to change in any way. That decision had been in ridiculous deference to an article in McCall's Susan had clipped, opining that there was no quicker way to alienate your children from the family than to invade and remake their sanctuary as soon as they were off to school. That had been an argument for the history books. Heaven forbid that he should do anything to alienate Tilly's affections. Hollis had pushed for the meditation room that he had always believed would have put Tilly's southern exposure to good use. Susan had seemed to grasp the concept of meditation, but not so much the need for a special room, or, still less, the idea of Hollis actually meditating anytime or anywhere. In any event, she was not risking psychological damage to her daughter, who had spent not 10 minutes in that room in the last 8 months prior to leaving home. Alienation was not an option. Preserving Tilly's old habitat had not kept her visits home from having a surreal, alien quality to them. Although Tilly was in the house and more present physically than before she had left for college, her emotional presence was ever less substantial. Her seasonal visits were not as a returning daughter, but as a short-term tenant, a bed-and-breakfast guest whose pleasantries had an air of formality, uncommon to normal family relations, and unprecedented in the Johns family. The roving social life that had so dominated Tilly's later high school years had all but disappeared, and, when she was not doing laundry or helping Susan cook or decorating the tree with her brothers, she had spent much of her time alone, reading her books and listening to secret music on a pair of collapsible headphones she kept in her purse. She had been perfectly courteous, pleasant, and helpful. Unnaturally, antiseptically so. She had not sought Hollis out for conversation or companionship, but she had not run from him either. She answered his questions about Wesleyan and Connecticut and her studies, elaborating here and there as a foreign tourist might elaborate on some of the fond eccentricities of the place she calls home, the place where she currently is not. Her inquiries of Hollis were but polite contributions to subjects he took the initiative to broach: his excellent health, his rising stock as a mover and shaker at OFSC, the possibility that he might be selected to participate in the 2001 Pacific Rim Banking Conference in Tokyo, his budding interest in Buddhism, his intention to relearn the guitar, her glassy interest in these things. "Oh, my dad, Japan, well, that does sound interesting," was just enough to satisfy the requirements of conversational decorum. When, in a surprisingly desperate effort to smash through the veneer of formality, Hollis had jokingly reminisced about the time when there had been no respect between them at all, "I was thinking about that damn stereo of yours the other day, Tilly, and I have to say, the earphones are a dramatic improvement." Tilly had declined to take the bait, instead smiling sweetly and changing the subject. The Christmas of Tilly's senior year, she did not return to Ohio. Susan's dinner table synopsis had been that Tilly was using the break to interview for editing jobs on the West Coast. "Editing? I thought she was going to write a book." "I'm sure she will, but for now she's into editing."
"Editing what?"
"I don't know."
"Does she know?"
"I don't know if she knows, Hollis. Magazines? LA Quarterly or something like that? That's one of the interviews, anyway."
"Magazines? I thought you wanted to write books. What happened to books? You know, literature."
"You don't just start out writing best-selling novels."
"Why not?"
"You just don't."
"Is she working on one, at least?"
"Not that I'm aware of. Don't be in such a hurry, Hollis."
"Why not?"
"Because when she starts writing, God only knows what she'll want to write."
That night in bed, as Susan drifted off with an irritating lack of concern, Hollis had significantly downgraded his expectations for Tilly from best-selling novelist to career magazine editor, whose job it was to redline and punch up in-depth articles on the latest anklet fashion trends and the 10 bedroom secrets every spouse needs to know. His daughter was destined to be the person whose job it was to cull the split infinitives from the pages of McCall's. Like picking the flies out of horse shit, he had thought. In his mind, he saw Tilly not as a beautiful 21-year-old, but as a leather-skinned, chain-smoking 65-year-old, hunched over a keyboard in the blue glow of an editing cubicle. Respected by her younger colleagues for her facility with language and her institutional knowledge of a publication read by teenagers and stage mothers everywhere, and remembered affectionately for the extra-salty personality she would end up affecting in order to cover for the bitterness of a wasted education. But for all his concern over the downward shift in Tilly's professional trajectory, Hollis had overlooked the West Coast connections of her first job interviews. It had not been a detail that stood out from the rest of the information he had been given to process, and it was not something that, in and of itself, concerned him. But perhaps he should have smelled Hollywood, even then. For it should not have been the job of editing, but the place of editing, that gave him pause. California. Los Angeles. As he had since come to realize, Tilly's future would not be lost to a career of menial editing, but to the plague of America's entertainment culture. He should have somehow intuited that California interviews were a harbinger of doom. He should have suspected that his only daughter was soon to be sucked, body and soul, into the glittering maelstrom of narcissistic whoring that rewarded the insipid, the violent, and the prurient, callously discarding everything and everyone else into the scrap heap of wasted humanity. He had failed to recognize the first small step on a slippery slope that led directly into the lion's den. Before Hollis had fully perceived the reality of the situation, his only daughter, Matilda Leona Johns, the little girl who had hidden away in the basement to play submarine adventure with Greta the Boiler, who had won the Ohio Mayfield Award for short fiction, who had graduated from the renowned Wesleyan University in Middletown, Connecticut, who had edited the Los Angeles Quarterly, was bearing her body on celluloid for public viewing and accumulating a carnal knowledge of movie directors. Hollywood speak for pimps, twice her age. For all that education and enough time to pull herself together, Tilly was a hellion still. It was as though she were looking for failure. Not failure, no. Personal destruction. Tilly's recent success as an actor might disguise that inevitability, but it would not prevent it.
And while the critical accolades and growing public fanfare had certainly pleased Susan, who had finally felt free to stop apologizing for her daughter's public persona, Tilly was officially no longer an Ohioan daughter, and everyone knew it. She was now one of them. The cult of entertainment had bared its tabloid fangs. There was nothing left but the slow, gruesome devouring and the roar of the crowd. The door to the junk room opened, and Ben emerged with his headphones still over his ears, knocking the guitar on the doorframe as he stepped into the hall. He froze in alarm as he laid eyes on his father, sitting on the stairs.
"Careful there, partner," Hollis said.
Ben's shallow features flooded over.
"Dad, it was an accident, Dad. I didn't mean to do it. I...
"It's okay, it's okay. Just be careful."
"Dad, hey, Dad, can I have this?"
He held the stringless guitar out in front of him by the neck, like he was posing with a record-setting halibut.
"I bought that for your mother a long time ago, back when we were in Dayton."
"Can I have it, Dad, please?"
"You'll have to ask your mother when she comes back."
"When is she coming back?"
"Oh, I don't know, Ben. When she's good and ready to come home, I guess."
"Can I take... Hey, Dad?"
"Yes?"
"Can I take this up to my room?"
"If you're careful, I suppose that would be all right. Will you be very careful?"
"Yes, I will be very careful, Dad. I will be very careful. Hey, Dad?"
"Yes, Ben?"
"Why come you're sitting on the stairs all the way down here?"
"Oh, doing some laundry."
"Mom does the laundry, doesn't she, Dad?"
"Yes, she does."
"But not when she's gone."
"Right."
"I was in the junk room."
"I see that. You know, your sister used to hide herself away in that room when she was a little girl."
"She did? Tilly did that?"
"Yep."
"Why was Tilly hiding, Dad? Why come Tilly was hiding in the junk room?" His son whispers these words, stooping a little in Hollis's direction, as if the walls had ears, and the rooms on this level of the house had memories of their own. As if Greta were listening.
"Would you like to cook steaks out on the grill tonight?"
"Me? Cook steaks out on the grill like you do sometimes?"
"Sure, it's just you and me again. Another bachelor's night. And what do we say about bachelor's night?"
"Anything goes and nobody knows. Ha ha!
Good. Let's go fire up that grill."
"Hey, Dad?"
"Yes?"
"Why come Tilly was hiding in the junk room?"